This episode of Science Studio originally aired June 14th, 2009.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli. There are many ways that a scientist can be developed in modern universities. You can get PhDs in almost anything: physics, chemistry, biology. So what we're going to do today, we're going to talk about a particular program that's becoming very popular around the world, and that is studies in the environment, environmental science and engineering, ESE. And we're going to talk with two recent graduates from the University of Texas at El Paso who will tell us how they got into science, why they chose to do an ESE program, and what they did for their research and what expertise they're going to go out into the wide world with. And so, Russ, who are these two guests?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio two of our most recent, that means 2009, graduates from the Environmental Science and Engineering program, which is an interdisciplinary program. And first, we have Dr. Steve Forbes. And second, we have Dr. Dennis Wambuga. Steve, Dennis, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's great. Here. Steve Forbes, I mean, you've already got a fortune stashed away anyway, so you know, I'm not quite sure what you need to do, but we'll start with you, Steve. You're obviously an older student. You're not one of these fellows like Russ and I that went straight from high school into education, PhD, before we were 28 or whatever. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your journey. How did you get from where you were, and why into science, why into environmental science?
Well, I started in environmental in the mining field. My undergraduate's in mining from the University of Nevada. And
are you from Nevada, or where did you...
I'm from New York City.
You're from New York City. Way. Padron.
That's another story in by itself. I was on my own some time. I was young and ended up in Nevada. And after the military, went to the UNR and became a mining engineer with the focus of environmental. And through that, came to Texas through the uranium industry doing environmental work. And through Three Mile Island happened, the uranium industry went bust. And I went back to school and my master's for UTSA in environmental science. And at that time, this is 20 years ago, I decided to pursue a PhD. But there wasn't a PhD program for environmental degradation in developing countries, which is what I was interested in. And I was looking for the last, whether it was 20 years, I was looking for a program like that. And I was getting to the wire when I was ultimately going to go through these long-distance programs. And UTEP and UTSA started a long-distance program where you could start. I could be in UTSA, San Antonio, which is where I live now and have been there for 30 years, and sit in there and then take classes here. But that didn't work out. I was one of the only students, one reason.
Tell us, before you carry on with this nice story, why were you interested in environmental degradation in underdeveloped or developing countries?
Yeah, and what exactly does that mean to you?
I don't know. I couldn't. A lot of people ask me that, actually, and I don't know that I can answer it specifically. I couldn't come. When I was in the military, I was in North Africa, and I was in Morocco, and it's where I first saw poverty at. It's an image. An image I have in Casablanca of people living in dump sites. It's always stuck with me. Before that, I was a kid on my own. I was on the reservations, living on reservations in Nevada. Not living on them so much, but the Indians.
Near them.
They were taking care. Yeah. They were helping me out and taking care of me every once in a while. So I saw what was going on there, and it always occurred to me this shouldn't be. And as I went into the environmental field, the two kind of came together. And so that's how I became. I've always been an environmentalist.
Okay, so that's an interesting story. We're going to come back to it quite a bit, I'm sure. Dennis, tell us a little bit about how you became interested in science and in environment to begin with.
I guess my history in science goes back to my early days back in Kenya. By the way, I come from Kenya. I did my first degree in agriculture, so goes back to then. And then I worked for a couple of years with the government, and then I decided to actually pursue the field of natural resources and the environment. So I did apply to go to the University of Oxford, and I did my forestry degree at the Oxford Forestry Institute.
That's the Oxford?
Yes, University of Oxford. that's the Oxford. I went to Queen's College. I know you know about that. But that's really set the ground for me. And while I went to do that, my master's there, I was working for an international organization which was actually dealing with natural resource issues, the International Center for Research in Agroforestry, ICRAF. They now call themselves the World Agroforestry Center. But that is how I came into this field of environment, natural resources. And then later on when I came over here, I decided to pursue the same field.
Made you decide to come here? You're in Oxford, Queen's College. And
yes. My family and I came over here. We lived in Missouri for 5 years. Then I came to visit an assistant professor who happened to be a relative of my wife. And when I came and looked around UTEP, I fell in love with it. And I said, and then I was told about the ESE program.
Right.
I went and met Dr. Gardea. And that was it. That was the beginning.
The rest is history.
The rest is history. Right. So I ended up here and got into the ESE program.
Your thesis work, this byproduct synergy.
Yes, my PhD thesis was on byproduct synergy, recovering the indigo waste from textile effluent after the stonewashing process.
So the point there is that indigo is the dye that's used for making jeans, that sort of blue color. And much prized is the washed jeans, where the color is washed away almost.
Right.
And all that dye goes somewhere, and that's where you step in.
Yes, and you can recover that dye. There's nothing wrong with it. So if you can
just
recover
it,
you can save the costs, and you can use it to make a product. Just next thing.
Yeah, and one of the industrial person we used to work with said, you know, we buy these jeans from Levi's for $25. We beat the heck out of them and sell them to you for $50. That's the business. And so, Dennis, you would also know something about this topic that we were talking about, environmental degradation in developing countries. Have you seen any?
Well, I was working with the Minister of Agriculture back in Kenya and also the International Center for Research in Agroforestry. Both of them were actually dealing with the natural resource issues, including the soils, including crops, including livestock, all those areas. So I have worked in this field for a long, long time. And I have seen poverty firsthand. There's a lot we can talk about poverty, whether it is urban or rural. We have worked with both. I have worked mostly with rural poverty because of my employers.
Let's talk a little bit about agriculture, because for people who have never been to Africa, and both of you have been to Africa, your focus, in fact, both of you, it's a fascinating how you both come to be here around this table from such different paths and yet have such a synergy between the two of your interests. But let's talk about Africa and agriculture. Is it as bad as the rest of the world seems to think? I mean, I don't mean that the farming is bad, but the condition, the climate change,
Steve, chime
the soil.
In too with Dennis. Mm-hmm.
Let me say this. First of all, what you see is probably not the right picture, what the West sees, what the people see, actually, because if you really go back, journalism is about looking for the most sensational stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'm telling you here and now, there are a lot of very good stories from Africa. They actually never get reported. There are very successful stories about agriculture. I myself started a small project when I was doing some consultancy on drip irrigation. And I had FAO and the World Bank actually come say, people, this is a model and we could multiply this. But that was just about the time when we were coming over to this country. So we didn't ever push that idea, and I really never went back to follow that up.
But irrigation was from subterranean sources.
This was actually used just the normal streams, because you're using very little amount of water. Mm-hmm. You use just a very small handheld pump. You pump the water up, and then you drive it down by gravity.
Okay.
And because you are using drip, just very little amounts.
Sustainable is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
And these are the kinds of stories you never really get reported, because, who wants to hear about this kind of stuff?
But, well, we do.
You know.
Yeah, we do.
You know, a lot of people want stories which really get reported are those big things like poverty and disease and all that kind of stuff.
You could argue that those stories are important in order to generate an understanding in the West of what needs to be done in Africa, and therefore stimulate private people and governments to help.
If I may, I think that the progress that you're talking about are showcase. If you took the norm,
the people, there's a good share of farming, subsistence farming, that things like drip irrigation is a new technology for a lot of those farmers. So we're introducing it to them, and then some of them use it very successfully. But still, it's not rampant or throughout Africa. Still, this need. In Uganda, they've gone through a big drought period and then followed by huge floods. This type of thing, there's still very difficult conditions going on. So as Dennis says, there's that the good stories don't get talked about. These other ones kind of dominate them. But there are a lot of people, you know, a good share, a third of the population in the world is under extreme poverty.
So tell us then, now with your degree, what is it that you are now trying to do to bring back all this education, all this sort of hands-on doing things? What is your immediate goal?
Well, with the PhD, with the dissertation I've developed a, what I call SUDEX, which is Sustainable Development Extension Service. It's kind of modeled after the Agricultural Extension Service that almost all countries have in the U.S. and so forth, where SUDEX will help provide this kind of link between the farmer who doesn't know about drip irrigation. We won't do it for them. We do very much a lot of participatory. We will go into the villages. We help the villages decide for themselves rather than an NGO coming in and telling them what they need. They determine what it is they need for themselves because they know they're living it. But they know they don't have the resources or know where to go. Then we help them go find those resources, and they become
after they've developed their own plan,
right?
Rather than being preached to,
right. So they're not waiting for an NGO to come in and tell them what it is that they want. They know what they want, and a lot of times it isn't what they're being told that they want. But when an NGO comes in and says, "Well, we want to build a water well," we really don't want a water well. We need a school. Well, we don't do schools, so you'll take our water well. And then you have a water well that's because the village isn't going to say no.
So you're a facilitator.
Exactly.
Right?
Facilitator,
coordinator. You're not saying that I know all about artesian wells or solar-powered schools. You simply have a broad picture of what's available, what's possible, and then wait for people to ask you how to help.
Use the term extensionalist, which is a facilitator, coordinator.
Right.
I would like to pick it up from where Steve left off. There are two areas which are usually problematic in development work in developing countries. One is the resources to get these things done. And the second part is the technical know-how. So even when you go in and the folks down there will say, these are our priorities. And they're very good at prioritizing what they really want in terms of projects or what can help them. But there is always then the question of resources. And also, if you are talking about, say, an artesian well, or something, you need technical expertise. There is a way that that kind of thing works. So it's like you need some help, technical assistance, and then you need to mobilize the resources. And usually that's those two things actually bottlenecks in actually getting a successful program or project going.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chinelli and two recent PhD recipients, Steve and Dennis, from the Environmental Science and Engineering program at UT El Paso. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Facing cancer once is daunting enough, but the shock of relapse can be crushing.
Three new studies now confirm what keeps tumors coming back is a so-called cancer stem cell. If true, we can foresee therapies that greatly extend cancer survival.
Scientists have debated the existence of cancer stem cells, but the new evidence suggests tumors contain stem cells that are often dormant, shielding them from chemotherapy.
After treatment and given enough time, the surviving stem cells divide, producing more cancer stem cells as well as differentiating into a variety of cells found in a tumor. This ability to produce cells with varying characteristics may help explain metastasis when cancer cells are able to migrate and invade other organs.
Researchers in these new studies worked with tumors in the brain, skin, and gut of mice. One group found a way to label brain tumor stem cells, track them, and saw them survive chemotherapy. But when researchers repeated the experiment with a genetic trick that prevented stem cell replication, the tumors shrank.
Other researchers focused on benign intestinal tumor cells that are the precursor to cancer. They labeled the cancer stem cells and introduced the gene that made them glow. The tumors they produced glowed the same color, confirming that the tumor cells came from the stem cells.
The last group of researchers labeled individual skin tumor cells and tracked them. Most tumor cells divided a few times before dying out. A tiny group of tumor cells continued to grow and divide, which further supports the existence of cancer stem cells.
These studies provide a powerful new approach to cancer therapy.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, where our guests are two recent graduates of the Environmental Science and Engineering program, Dr. Steve Forbes and Dr. Dennis Wambuger. And so what we're talking about here, and Dennis, I would like to ask you, from your perspective, when Steve was telling me about this idea of going into the village and letting the people figure out and then helping get what they need, my impression of that was, well, you know, I'm a villager, and here comes somebody from the West, and he's telling me what I need, and, you know, so there's sort of an arrogance and instead of letting me develop it. I mean, is there...
Sudex isn't going in and telling them.
No. I'm saying you're doing the opposite.
Right.
Okay,
right.
You're doing it right.
Yeah.
And what I want to ask Dennis is that something that you've experienced or seen where there's sort of an arrogance coming in? And
I have seen in my years, I think, doing consultants work in this field, I have seen a lot of models, particularly talking about NGOs, and I know lots of them and I worked with lots of them. There is actually a problem when you are coming as an outsider and usually telling people what to do or what is good for them. And what I think is a good model is to have somebody on the ground there. Mm-hmm. You can work with, for example, who is accepted, who is an opinion leader, who is accepted by the community. You integrate that. And then with your knowledge, because your knowledge is coming from outside, and now with this person from, you know, who is accepted by the local community, you start better chances of succeeding in whatever you are doing.
Yeah. Now, Steve, you know, you've told me some stories. Maybe you could tell us, our listeners, a little story about going out and camping in some remote place. Those are fascinating stories, and he has lots of photographs and so on, which we hope to make available at some point in the future. Tell us just one experience.
I think the one of the villages I work in Ghana, and I've worked there a long time, because like Dennis says, it's building a relationship of trust. Until we build that, we're not going to do any good. So I've been going back and forth for the last 5 years, and we do what we call a participatory community development. It's a staged approach, and I agree 100% that we need someone, when we look for someone, to be what we call an extensionalist there who's from the community. But until that time, we don't always have that.
So, but you're also out there in the remote area, sleeping there in the village, and without as many amenities as we might normally expect, and so on and so forth.
Well, I don't know what really to say. I mean, you know, some of them.
It was uncomfortable, I'm
sure.
It
isn't all that uncomfortable. Oh. The people like the fact that you're there, and I work with EWB Engineer Without Borders groups, and so the students are interacting. So it's
what I mean by that is some of us here, you know, we would have this fantasy about going out in the middle of some remote place where there were lots of wild animals and at night sleeping on the ground and hearing things, and you know. Did you have those experiences?
No, not really. I've been to places where there's wild animals, but you know, I never get this feeling of discomfort.
Not discomfort, sort of wonder.
Oh, absolutely.
If you want wild animals, Cincinnati Avenue, Friday night. Okay, it's pretty interesting. I remember reading a book by Paul Theroux. It was called The Dark Star, and I'm a great fan of Paul Theroux. When he went by bus from Cairo all the way down to Cape Town, and had all sorts of adventures. He went canoeing down the Zambezi, but he lived sort of rough. He just lived amongst the people. He wouldn't stay in hotels very often. But he came away in the sort of conclusion of this book, having gone around Africa, is that a lot of these NGOs do far more harm than they do good. Mm-hmm. You know, he was particularly ribald, I was going to say, about people like, and I won't mention the names, but with their white Land Rovers, all right? careening around the country in their white Land Rovers, telling people what to do. And he said from his experience, he'd seen villages where this sort of Western help had come in or been implanted, and others where they just got on and did what was natural, and it was chalk and cheese. One was now very much a dependent village, one where the Western organizations had come in, and the other was sort of self-sufficient and sustainable. So I'd like you to both... Do you think this is a fair image that he conjures up?
Yeah, I do. I think the punchline of what Sudex wants to do, what I call it, is sustainable self-sufficiency. What we're trying to lead them and help them, not lead, I shouldn't use that word, because we're not trying to lead them. They lead us, but that our ultimate goal is sustainable self-sufficiency.
Let me go back to, the paradigms, which are the so-called development paradigms by the World Bank. I'll mention the World Bank because that's acceptable to say. For many years, the World Bank had these changing development paradigms for Africa, including the structural adjustment programs, none of which worked because those things were being drawn up in Washington, and then they would be imposed on the people in the developing countries. Those people were left with was these huge debts. In the recent years, we have been talking about forgiving debts, which actually comes from there. I talk about this because I worked with one project in my country as a consultant. There was this huge project, a huge irrigation project, which was funded by the World Bank. And what happened is that once the people are settled there, for some reason the river changed course, so the water disappeared, and so the irrigation scheme was left high and dry. And the worst thing was not the commercial crops they were growing, it was actually the food that these people... So when we went there, we found people starving. But the government was still paying this huge loan to the World Bank, but this huge project had already failed, totally failed. And we were sent out there to try to do a feasibility study to see how it can be revived. Well, we did that study. When we went back to look at what the World Bank did, you cannot imagine the number of mistakes which were really done from the beginning. And frankly, a lot of that money ended up in Switzerland.
Well, that's the other feature, right?
So, and I can tell you this because this was firsthand. This was me. And
well, you have an account in Switzerland.
We went. I'm talking about discovering the people who took the money. So the people there, well, we did what we had to do. And in fact, that feasibility study was only implemented when we were here. This was like 10 years later. They implemented that and they have revived the scheme. So about 100,000 hectares of irrigation scheme somewhere in Tana River. But what I was trying to say is that for a lot of the NGOs, these huge organizations, they go there. They really don't understand the facts on the ground, and usually they recommend the wrong solutions to the problems. And I know, again, of another organization, I'm not going to mention that, but they have been in the ground for 15 years when we visited there to see what they have done. This is an international NGO. They had only a couple of pit latrines in the rural areas. That's all they could show for it.
So, I mean, the implication is here that we've been doing this, and the West, has been sort of trying to do what it thinks is the right thing. I mean, I don't think it's a malevolent operation.
No.
It's just perhaps not. It's undereducated about what's needed.
Exactly.
Ignorance.
A lot of it's starting at the top. The World Bank and those guys are starting at the top. They like to talk about working at the bottom, and then they have staff in their Toyotas with the white cars and the huge antennas that working, so they drive to the villages.
Right.
But they're really coming down, trickling from the top. They're going through the governments, and the funds are all going.
Is it improving? That's what I was trying to get to. We've been doing this 50 years, 60 years.
Mm-hmm. Well,
is it improving?
People like Steve are the ones who can improve this. And if, for example, I was working with him, trust me, there is a lot I know on the ground, at the ground level.
Right.
There's a lot of Steve knows, a lot of techno stuff he can actually access from here, which we can use because I probably can understand it. So there's a very good bridge here.
Okay, but let me ask the question.
And that's the point.
We'd certainly love to send Ken Ellie to Kenya.
I know exactly the spot he wants to go.
It's Laja, isn't it?
Lamu.
Lamu.
I know where exactly
Lamu
is. I know where exactly
he
wants
tell
to
you
go.
About
that's a different story. And even what I'm doing, it still applies to that. I'm now doing risk assessments.
Environmental risk assessment.
Human health risk assessment.
The question I want to ask, too, because when I was first here, I went to Honduras, something set up, and it became immediately obvious to me. I didn't know what I was doing, But it became immediately obvious to me that what I was doing there was not correct, and I had to ask the people what to do. And it was when I started talking to Steve, I realized that I had this experience, and without realizing, the whole concept. You know, you go in there, and the people didn't want to hear about synchrotrons. They needed to know about waste in their rivers, and, you know, I had them work in teams. But my question to both of you is, why has it taken us so long to figure out what seems to me to be kind of an obvious thing?
I don't know. I couldn't answer the question why. I think so much of it has been, you look at the globalization we're going through in the last 2 years. You talk about 60 years, almost 100 years of trying to eradicate poverty, and the progress has been relatively nil. But in terms of the communication sources we have now and the globalization we have now, and sometimes it's actually an advantage. If I can coordinate with all the Ghanaians and all the Kenyans that are here, it's an advantage. So that all the people that have been doing all this great work over all these years, it's these little pit latrines and wells here, they're not culminating into something that's doing something the village as a whole is benefiting from.
Steve, you said before that you had witnessed slums in Morocco, I think,
right.
Okay?
Yeah.
And a recent Wall Street Journal article said that it was amazing to me that these mega cities had grown in India over the past 15 years, and that there was, 780 slums in India now, this enormous number caused economically because people are coming out of the countryside and going to these cities. And mm-hmm. So my question is, leading into that, did either of you see Slumdog Millionaire?
I saw it.
Okay, comments, please, because there were some people that, especially from India, didn't like that movie showing that stuff that was going on.
Well, my comment about it is I've been to India, and some of the movie, I thought was a great movie, I think some of the worst poverty I've seen is in the cities
in
India. Yeah. So I don't know what other to say, but I think it's very representative of the difficulties that India, in particular, and those type of things that you see, was very.
Well, the bigger question is, I mean, Russ is alluding to the fact there's this enormous population. Mm. Africa is going through climate change, desertification of certain areas, bad politics to bad farming. Mugabe is always held up as an example of a bad man. What's the population of Africa doing these days?
I think there has been a fairly good change in terms of slowing down the population in Africa. But frankly, in my estimation, the problem is not really population. It goes to things like bad politics and the degradation of the environment and the competition and the climate itself. I mean, the weather changes so much. I mean, if you look at the rainfall patterns, they've been changing in the recent years.
In a systematic way?
Just fluctuating, but I think there's also a general trend in the global climate change there. For example, in Africa, if you miss one rainy season or two, it's very devastating. If you look at, say, people like, the Maasai, for example, their livestock just disappears.
And they're nomadic, right?
And they're nomadic.
They follow the rain.
And they don't farm, so that's their food. They start starving right there.
Right.
But going back through history, this has been a pattern.
Yeah, but in the recent past, what has been happening now because of, like I said, other factors like bad politics, they all mix up.
Well, frontiers. I mean, the European designated where one country starts and another stops. Mm. Well, anyway, that's going to have to wrap it up, gentlemen. So we thank you very much for being here on Science Studio. It's been fascinating. We'd really like to do another few programs. But as usual, 30 minutes is all Norman Martinez allocates. And so we've had our share.
And so thanks, Dr. Forbes and Dr. Wambuga. And thanks to Norman Martinez, our producer.
And thank you for listening to Science Studio. We shall be back next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with today's Life Sciences Flash. The U.S. Health and Human Services Department has $40 million in grants for physicians and hospitals. The money is aimed at curbing preterm births and early elective deliveries. The money will also go to improving prenatal care for women covered by Medicaid. This Life Sciences Flash brought to you by Synapse, the region's life sciences news digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.